Dr. Stein and I have gotten together, and we had some questions about some of the cases we've approached recently. And Dr. Stein, you've got some cases that maybe you want some help with the panel. We're going to use these cases as sort of a formulating ability to get people to get up and ask questions about the way things are managed.
All right. So thank you all very much for those overviews. Hopefully we'll walk through and get some additional opinions from the panel, all of whom are really expert in taking care of critically ill patients of a variety of flavors. We'll start with the first case. This is going to be a 48-year-old male. He comes into your ED with worsening abdominal pain over several days, nausea, emesis, no real past medical history. He describes himself as a social drinker, 2 to 4 beers per day. Take what you want for that definition. He is afebrile. Blood pressure is 90. Not today, Oscar. Okay. Blood pressure is 98 over 40. His heart rate's 110. Respiratory rate's 32. Going back to what Dr. Lissauer was talking about, he's sitting at 98% on 2 liters. Got a white count of 12.2. Hemoglobin's okay. You do notice that he has significant hyperamylasemia and an elevated lipase. You can see a CT scan there. Pretty classic acute pancreatitis. And you see his chest x-ray, as shown there, pretty unremarkable. Comes up to your ICU. His blood pressure is a little bit lower, 88 over 54, still afebrile. He is now tachycardic to 130. He is tachypneic, and he is now sitting 92% on 2 liters. Blood gas is shown, 7.22, 38, 52, 92% saturation. Start him on levofed. What are we going to do with this guy? Dr. Lissauer, how do you want to approach this patient who comes up? And I throw out a couple of things. Put him on non rebreather, leave him alone, intubate him, high flow. What do you want to do with this guy?
This is one where I think you have to be proactive. He's going to get worse before he gets better. And since you know he's going to get worse, I would absolutely intubate him. And I would put him on settings, as Dr. Kozar mentioned, protective ventilation, 60 Cs per kilo. But absolutely, you can control his CO2, his pH a little bit better, even though it's predominantly metabolic at the moment. That's how I would start, and give him his appropriate fluid resuscitation. Even though he's not septic and it's pancreatitis, it's SIRS and he's hypotensive.
I thought we weren't allowed to call it SIRS anymore.
Well, it's not part of the sepsis definition. It still exists.
We can still call it SIRS. Anybody disagree? This guy should not be intubated? Everybody want to intubate him? Go ahead.
Who in the crowd doesn't want to intubate him? Yeah.
Yeah, we're all good with intubating this guy? Okay. So we do. We go ahead and intubate him. Go ahead and intubate him. He's on tidal volume. We put him on SIMV, and that's what gets picked. Tidal volume of 450, which is about 8 per kilo. PEEP's 16, saturating FiO2 of 80%. And this is what his chest x-ray looks like the next day. His blood gas now is 718, 58, 48, with a saturation of 88%. Dr. Cohen?
He was going to get worse before he got better, and he did. He did indeed. So now you've got. You have ARDS without a doubt by definition, and so all of the stuff that Rosemary so nicely summarized comes into play here, right? His PEEP's going to go up, his FiO2 is going to go up, and you need to start thinking about the plan B and C, doing everything you can with recruitment maneuvers, depending on whether you prone at your place. That's what's coming, because at the same time, the issue with this guy is you're resuscitating him, which is clearly making his lungs worse, but also keeping him alive, through the sequelae of his, pancreatitis and the inflammation that brings.
Dr. Kozar, any thoughts on it? Do you have any specific triggers that you would use to say, okay, this is a good candidate for proning? We should go ahead. I didn't give you his respiratory rate here, but obviously he's dysynchronous, dose paralytics. How do you make those decisions, and when do you kind of pull the trigger? Is there any data to say when is a good idea, or is it just all, as my grandmother would say, gestalt?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you have to kind of go through the steps and do the things that you can do to get you up to that point, and then you got to think about the individual patient. We hadn't talked about this, but I think it's, kind of out there of the amount of fluid resuscitation, and are we over resuscitating patients or resuscitating with the wrong fluid that are contributing to chest x-rays like this? And I think that's something as we go forward with patients with sepsis or pancreatitis or burns or whatever, that maybe we can learn some things that aren't pushing the limit so much to this. But I would, you know, adequately resuscitate the patient. I would, you know, and then kind of deal with the sequelae of it. But sedation, and if you have to paralyze it, and, you know, if you've got a blood gas like that and you've done all that, you need to do something different. And so, you know, you're kind of at the point where you need to think about proning them.
Can I just add?
Yeah, please, so, no. Don't wait for me.
Oh, great. So I would absolutely
you are not,
agree.
You were chosen because you were not a quiet bunch.
Oh, good. Yeah, absolutely. I've got to talk over Oscar quickly. So I agree with what Rosemary said. You know, coming out of the trauma literature and suggesting that a lot of the sequelae that we used to see were from resuscitating essentially with red blood cells and a ton of crystalloid, which caused all kinds of iatrogenic problems. And no matter what you believe about what the right ratio is, even if that's a worthwhile question anymore, there's something in the special sauce of a plasma-based resuscitation or a whole blood-based resuscitation that quiets or attenuates or modulates that inflammatory response, which this patient has to beat the band. And so I don't think there is data yet to hang my hat on, but, you know, I'd very seriously think about resuscitating this patient with some sort of colloid, with some sort of plasma. There is good data coming out of Europe to suggest maybe we should resuscitate septic patients that way, that we should resuscitate burn patients that way. And again, that's attenuating that damp. I mean, this is the classic sort of sterile inflammatory response. The other thing I would just say is, you know, this is full court press from an ARDS standpoint. I trained, you know, under some of the ARDS, the ARDS intelligentsia. This patient would be paralyzed, yeah. And I don't think that anyone should think twice. You know, yes, it's appropriate to give them a single dose of paralytic to try to get you through. This patient's going to be paralyzed, and they're going to be paralyzed for a long time, because to attenuate that biologic lung injury, you want them making zero respiratory effort on their own. And you're going to be in this for the long haul. So now is the time.
Yeah, I take the patient out of the equation. They are no longer going to be a part. They're not having any say in this. And if I can get their INR to whatever trigger your institution allows it, I want plasma in this patient. It's free radical scavenging. And there's a secret sauce. I think that's one of the greatest words on the modern era about plasma. But yeah, day two, this is where we are. Or 12 hours we are, ECMO.
Yeah, you want to go, you're just pulling the trigger?
I mean, early is best. And if you wait any longer, you're just going to put this guy further and further behind.
But
source control.
Stole it, Matt. Just out of curiosity, who has ECMO available to them at their institution in the audience?
Take me to their places.
So about 50%? Who doesn't? Because people don't vote. We know how that goes. Yeah, it's about 50%. So for those of you, if anybody wouldn't mind, who don't have ECMO available, and you got this patient, and I'll just go to here, because hang on one second. I'll ask my question in a second. He gets prone. He gets started on Nimbec strip. Those are his vent settings. That's his chest x-ray. His ABG.
The rabbit hole was 48 hours ago.
Not my rabbit hole. It's a patient. So what do you people who don't... Oh, please go ahead.
Why not APRV as your initial vent setting when he first got admitted?
Great question.
I'm not allowed to answer that question. I come from the Shock Trauma Center of Baltimore. For those of you who don't know what that means.
What is APRV?
Anybody?
I think that's a legitimate question. I think the pro-APRV answer is you can mitigate lung injury, distribute gas in a way where even if your release volumes are larger than what we classically say is a protective volume, because you're distributing it through the whole lung, each alveoli doesn't stretch much. So you actually can protect with APRV, keep a lot of the lung open. That's the pro literature. The downside is I think it takes a lot of effort to do that appropriately and well, every patient, every time, 24/7. So I came from a center where we use a lot of APRV, and I'm very pro APRV. In my current institution, not all of our RTs, not all of our faculty, not all of our fellows and residents can do that. So if someone is on APRV, you come in the morning, the wonky settings on APRV that aren't quite right for the patient are probably worse than what you would have in other situations on other modes. That being said, it's also about data. The randomized appropriate data isn't there to say APRV is better than anything else. I personally believe it, but that's, you know, again, I can't say that's the right thing to do because the real good trial isn't there.
Yeah, I think we do VDR, high frequency oscillatory. Something. I mean, if that it would tumble to that, before we could get the ECMO team in.
Yes.
Brian Williams from Parkland Hospital. I'm a fan of APRV, but the problem is not all the faculty work. So we APRV in the morning, come back the next day,
other setting. That sounds very similar to what I am.
It's like a proning trial. You just do it for a couple hours.
So my question for you is about proning, because I'm a fan of that as well. However, I think the data says you do it within 48 hours or it's not effective. And we typically wait, you know, a day, try this. Day two, you try that. Then it's day three or four. Then you prone them. But by that time, my understanding is that the data says that's too late to make any difference in their mortality. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's also faculty dependent. I have a fairly big group. I do think early is better. I agree with Oscar that the ship left at the previous slide. And at that slide, you know, once the patient started getting worse and clearly met Berlin criteria for either moderate or severe ARDS, we're thinking about proning. And if you can rescue them, great. And if not, within that first day or two, you know, as you mentioned, we want to prone early rather than late. But, you know, knowing the data and then prospectively following a patient hour to hour, day to day, it's a little bit different. So it's tough to, oh, wait, I can just do this and they'll get a little better. And then I don't have to prone is a cognitive bias I think we all have that we sort of have to step back from. So it makes it tough.
You know, I would still prone even if it were late, right? I mean, if our back was against the wall and it took more than 48 hours to get our back against the wall, I would do it. As a provocative statement that I can't back up, I would say that in these trials, there's so much unmeasured confounding, right? That's the problem with the APRV trial. That's the problem with resuscitation trials and trauma, with what's in the prone, and the comment is perfect that, you know, these patients, you know, you're on APRV in the morning and then you're on something else in the afternoon and then you get an RT who's not quite comfortable and you come in their wonky settings in the morning and say, what is going on here? You know, these patients require perfect care and really individualized treatment, right? There's the machine learning, you know, systems-based approach, and so much of that is unmeasured in these trials. And so it's nice to say, well, that trial showed this or that trial showed that. I think a lot of it, honestly, is really situational, and it's really not even hour to hour. It's minute to minute at the bedside with really, really good people. And to say, well, we can't do it because it's greater than 48 hours may not be really appropriate in, you know, that patient that second.
But this patient is getting to the point that they need less intensive care. We want to switch every little knob, every second that's not right. And sometimes they need time to get over the hill. Yes. They just need a little bit more time than you're willing to give because we want instantaneous gratification.
Well, I'm not suggesting that you wait a minute and then say, oh, that didn't work. And right, I would totally agree. That's really awful care. But on the other hand, you know, rounding on them once a day, putting some settings, telling the residents what to do, and then coming back can be really problematic, and it happens in a lot of centers.
Yeah,
you better rescue us.
Yeah, this gentleman here is going to rescue you. Yeah,
I concur. Reagan Bolig, UT Knoxville.
Nice time.
Yeah,
thank you. They match the socks.
the
interventions you guys are talking about. We went through developing a protocol to, you know, how do we do these. And we started looking at them as, you know, tier one, tier two, tier three. And as we discussed those and looking at the timing, we realized it can't work like that. What are your thoughts on how, what are the triggers for each of those, the steroids, the proning? And one thing we found is when we do start proning, we get the bed, we order it. It's not even, the patient's not prone until 12 to 14 hours after that.
Yeah.
And so, and I agree with Oscar, we call Costello frequently now for get transferred to ECMO to you guys. So
I think this is the situational awareness you describe of a good ICU, knowing this patient, right? I mean, you can tell on slide one, this patient's going to go south and they're going to get much worse before they get better. And that's the time to order the bed, think about your ECMO capabilities, make sure you've got your ART team on it. You know, thinking about all those things, you know, agreed. You come in the morning and you're on rounds and trying to make decisions on, oh, the patient went south at midnight, you're way too late.
We try and set expectations with the residents, which is, you know, kind of tough, saying, yeah, listen, by this time we got to be making these calls. If this is happening, you need to do that. And that seems to be a go-along way as well. Thanks, Ed.
All right, in the interest of moving along, this patient was in fact cannulated for ECMO. So their X-ray upper left, 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month with tracheostomy, and then when the patient got decannulated at 2 months later. My questions, though, about this is, number one, was ECMO necessary? It sounds like we did all, no? Matt says no.
Look, there's no long, this too long. I mean, you're going to, you have no prediction on that. If source control is gained and it takes 2 months or it takes 2 days, you do not know what that inflammatory modulation is going to be. And
yeah.
I think you have to get after it quickly, though, whether it's VDR or APRV or ECMO or proning, do it quick, get the patient off the picture, move on.
I think
then be set for the long haul.
I think we've all seen spectacular successes with ECMO, those of us that have done this. And going to Dr. Cohen's point, I think the randomized trials do leave a lot on the table in terms of bias and confounders. But the big data that's out there, the CSER trial and the Eolia trial, it's hard to say that there's a clear convincing evidence that ECMO actually made this person survive, as opposed to maybe a day or two later they would have gotten over their hypoxia with proning, with paralysis, and it probably would have still been the same two-month course. Maybe it would have been longer. Maybe it would have been shorter. I'm very pro-ECMO. Don't get me wrong. I'm going to call to get this person cannulated. It's what I'm familiar with. It's what my institution does best, and I don't want to discourage anybody. But to say, was ECMO necessary? I don't think we can answer that honestly with a yes or a no. I just don't think the data is there.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Bumsi Arabindi. I'm a resident at the Baylor College of Medicine. My question was about proning safety if you're not doing it too often. Mm-hmm. I know at our institution, we don't use the special beds. We just, whenever we prone, just once every few months, we call over our anesthesia colleagues and they bring their pads and we just turn them over like we would for an operating table. And I was wondering, are there any concerns? Have you seen any mishaps when you're doing proning so infrequently, you know, as a rescue maneuver?
That's a great question.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
Yes, yes.
We all having done it both ways where we actually get a rotoprone bed. I've seen mishaps with that. I've also seen mishaps with sheets and towels and a big team trying to all coordinate. I don't know of any secrets other than trying to be coordinated, get a lot of people and
move slow.
Yeah, move slow.
I don't know why everybody has to move fast. It's like a nice slow process and then you don't pull things out.
There actually is some data in the nursing literature that talks about having teams of people who, it's a matter, it's like volume versus outcome, right? So the more you do it, the more familiar you are with it, and having protocols for it of how exactly it's done and including it in nursing training so that at least they're getting it in part of their annual competencies has been demonstrated to be associated with decreased complication rates. But it's a problem that all of us face.
Sometimes when we want lines out and we want to extubate a patient, even if they don't need to be prone, we just write a proning order and it all happens at once. It's like a one order epic thing.
All right, moving on to a completely different topic. We have an 86-year-old gentleman. He falls off a golf cart while he's playing 18 holes. He's out playing 18 holes. He does have a positive loss of consciousness. That's him. Initially, per EMS, he's confused, but he's following commands. He shows up to your center. He becomes less responsive en route. His blood pressure is now 210 over 110. His heart rate 68. His respiratory rate's 8. He is sitting okay in a non-rebreather. His GCS is clocked at 252, meaning he is localizing, opening eyes to pain and mumbling. He has a non-reactive right pupil, a briskly reactive left pupil. His past medical history has shown atrial fibrillation, diabetes, hypertension. He's, of course, on Pradaxa and as well as some other medications. And that is his head CT. So what are we going to do with this 86-year-old gentleman who was playing 18 holes, who now is in your ED with a large subdural with shift on Pradaxa with a low GCS, hypertensive, moderately bradycardic? Dr. Gulamandegi?
Guy was a fit of health just 10 minutes ago.
Just do it playing 18 holes.
So this guy needs, I mean, first thing I want to know is what's his advanced directive. That's number one. I do not want to steal this man's dignity at the end of life because that's what this is going to be. And despite our best efforts to want to do everything, this may be the one that we put the brakes on. Sadly, He's 82. He fits every single criteria that he is not going to get out of the hospital. So I'm really worried about it. But if I don't have an advanced directive, I'm going to intubate this patient. I'm going to be thinking about FFP and PCC and all these other things that you got to do to manage Pradaxa and whatever else they're going on. Mannitol is going to be on the list. Hypertonic saline. I'm going to throw it all at him if I don't have a course. But at the same time, I think I would probably be asking my partners, do I really want to do that? And, you know, okay. This is stage four trauma. You wouldn't operate on a stage four pancreas patient. So now we got to start thinking about what stage four trauma is. Like, do I really want to do all these things? And this is the one. This is the one that I would say my pride needs to get out of the way.
You know, I don't know. And only because I just finished rounding in the neurotrauma ICU. And, you know, there's a little old guy with this massive head bleed who, like, woke up in the day and is fine. And so I'm not sure.
Winner.
I know necessarily the outcome. I don't disagree with you.
I'm married.
The other way. The other way to think about it is to do all this stuff, give them a couple of days, and then sit down with the family and have this heart-to-heart talk early. I don't think they need to be intubated for 14 days.
No, I think you're exactly right. You have to set the record straight, like what your plan of attack is. And if you're going at it hard and heavy, you've got palliative care at the bedside instantaneously. Yep. That's what's going to save this patient, is the early palliative care per Debstein.
Yeah, I think you can do both things at once. We're really lucky to have one of our practitioners, one of our surgeons, Barry Platnick, who is also a palliative care expert, bringing palliative care quite literally on every patient in the ICU to the bedside, right? Because it's quality of life. It's not necessarily end of life, and they are very good at what they do. So I would absolutely go sort of full tilt boogie on trying to figure out what the advanced directives are, get palliative care to help with the situation, help with the family. They're very good at what they do. But on the other hand, I kind of agree. This is a fixable lesion, right? This is a subdural. This can be evacuated. This guy could wake up. And so, yes, you intubate him. You get neurosurgery. You absolutely reverse his Pradaxa with Praxbind or whatever you've got in your hospital as rapidly as possible. Because if you're going to have any chance of pulling him out of that trajectory, you got to act quickly in that regard at the same time.
Okay, Mitch, so then you do it. The neurosurgeons race this guy off to the OR. I'm stealing your case. And they evacuate that thing. And on the next day, the family says he didn't ever would have wanted this. And you extubate him. And the neurosurgeons come back to you like, hey, my 30-day mortalities are getting destroyed by you guys.
Then you remind them that if you transition the patient to hospice care, it doesn't count in the 30-day mortality, and therefore everybody's happy.
I just think that's an important point. If you start with palliative care, you've burned a bridge. There are some patients.
I think that's a misconception of palliative care.
You're right. You want to start with palliative care, but if you know this is somebody who was functional playing golf, and you're within an hour of his injury. Granted, the data says over 65 craniectomy bad. But this is the one who has a higher chance, I think. And so you're absolutely correct to have the discussion with the family, have the goals of care, involve palliative care, let them know that this may turn out very poorly. But at the same time, I think giving it the go early in a day or two to what Dr. Pozar said, and then if the person doesn't wake up very quickly, then start having that discussion. This is what we talked about, and lead that discussion.
I don't understand why you can't do both, right? I don't think calling palliative care to the bedside, especially to determine whether this patient's got an advanced directive before you do anything, in which case that may make this irrelevant. But I don't see calling palliative care as burning the bridge. I don't see the other side calling neurosurge, having them have a surgical success, and then saying, you know what, the patient doesn't want this, doesn't want to go through all the usual stuff that's up on the slide. Totally appropriate and okay. And if neurosurgery is working consistently with all the other teams in your ICU, they should have no issues, because this happens, unfortunately, frequently in any of our ICUs.
So I may have misspoke. Not calling palliative care, absolutely call them, involve them in the discussions. But I think it's very appropriate to pursue the full care course with palliative care on board to help you out until you get to the point where either, if there is an advanced directive, obviously, you know.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah, I mean,
but we're saying the same thing.
All right, in the interest of time, because we still have three more cases that we're not going to get through. Okay. Yeah, Brian.
My first comment is I consider palliative care part of the continuum of care. It's not something we, you know, we start at some point. But my question for you is, like, this patient, he's affluent, he's golfing. What if you have the same injury in the patient, like I deal with, that is undocumented or may not have the resources? That conversation that you have about end-of-life care is different. And so I'm just curious how you approach that.
Yeah, so I there's no litmus test of the patient other than their injury pattern for me. I don't think that I have a bias towards a different approach. The bias is towards what is comprehended by the individual family, whether they're affluent or they're poor, or black or they're white, Hispanic, whatever. If you can't wrap your arms around what we're talking about, I don't care who you are, it's going to be a really difficult situation. And that's the part that hurts. You know, when we wrote our paper on disparity of care, it was around the socioeconomic status outside the hospital, not inside. But I think we need to be as open and honest with these patients of whatever type about what we think the outcome is going to be. And I think bringing as many people to the table to do that is really important. And A2, I'm really worried about this guy.
I mean, same care and same goals, same care and same goals from a social situation or a palliative situation, whatever you would call it, for any patient, understanding completely that the social situation just makes that conversation sometimes difficult and makes ferreting out the goals a little more difficult. But frankly, there are plenty of patients with really, you know, who come from very advantaged socioeconomic backgrounds who are pretty screwed up with pretty screwed up families who have very difficult conversations. So I don't see it as being any different. I think same care.
I think we have to keep in mind our cognitive biases.
Sure.
The data out there, and some of it's yours, is there are discrepancies. And how do we ameliorate that? I find myself actually having to forcibly say, I'm going to do it the same way every time. And I think we all want to do it, but we all have our cognitive biases that we carry with us that we just have to recognize and get over. And it's about, you know, who's in the bed, what is best for that patient, what is best for their family. And, you know, I have to approach it that way every single time. And when I do that, I think it ameliorates some of that, but it is an issue in our society.
Yes, sir.
Bob Kurtz, Brooklyn. The real life situation is this man, well, he's playing golf or fantasy football or whatever, is going to come in without his advance directive. I mean, just poll the audience. This is about as hyper aware a group as exists in one room in the U.S. right now as to advance directives. People raise their hands if they have advance directives with them in their pocket.
No, it's a really good point. Yeah.
All right. So I think nobody actually walks around with them. And if people like us do not walk around with them, nobody does. So is anyone here really going to play God and say, okay, an 86-year-old with a large acute subdural and a big midline shift may have a close to 100% mortality, but are you going to say we're not going to do anything now?
No.
And the family's not going to come with them, and he's obviously not talking. I mean, for my part, I would do whatever I could for him, and especially the neurosurgical decompression, and do it as quick as I could. And we're going to have that discussion with the family or him if he ever wakes up later.
No question. I mean, that's what we're primed to do. We are primed to do all of those things. That's the modern mode. But at some level,
yeah. But I mean, we got to decide and do it first. I mean, that's what I would do, and I'm pretty sure that's what all of you would do.
Yeah.
I think the other important point is, you know, advanced directives aren't made for trauma.
No.
They're made for someone with end-stage cancer, and they don't honestly apply. Like, we don't know when this guy walks in the door what the long-term outcome is going to be. And that's why even when you have advanced directives, it's not that clear cut.
No, I mean, this guy was, I mean, he's obviously was just in their hospital a couple of weeks ago. He's
in every
one
the guy you were talking about.
Every one of our hospitals has this guy every day. I just extubated a guy that had this exact same thing. 24 hours after being having his craniectomy, he did not want to be intubated. He was awake telling us, pull the tube out. He's not ready. Pull the tube out. You want the tube out? Yes. Pull the tube out. He died. I mean, that's what he wanted. That's what we did.
But yes.
Nicholas Thiessen from Chandler, Arizona. I'm the trauma ICU director at our hospital, and snowbird season's coming up. And our ICU gets full of geriatric ground level falls, whatever the gravity in Chandler, Arizona is. But how do we energize the residents to become excited about taking care of geri trauma? That's the problem I'm having at our hospital, is that it becomes the, you know, we know how this case is going to end, right? And it becomes that kind of day after day after day. And I just see the residents becoming not really drawn towards trauma, acute care surgery, when a lot of our ICU is now full of geri trauma that's irreversible no matter what we do.
It's a hard question. I would say that it's not just our residents, it's us, right? How do we not get the dwindles in terms of, oh, we're now on day 5 and day 7 and day 14 and day whatever? What we try to teach, and maybe this is easier said than done, although I believe it as an intensivist, right? The little things matter in the ICU, right? You know, the big heroic, no news or slow news is good news in an ICU, and really great attention to detail and trying to get the residents excited about that attention to detail and the little things, right? All of that stuff adds up. And when you peter out on rounds and you don't talk about that system or those things seem less important, not only are the residents less energized, but the patients don't do well, right? Because the little things are going to matter for this guy. You know, once we get this cot evacuated, then he's going to get all the usual stuff, and that's going to be little things, and it's going to be boring, and it's going to be rote. But that's what we do as intensivists, and trying to make it that clear.
It's modeled behavior. I mean, honestly, if you're not engaged, they're not going to be engaged.
How's that for a non-answer answer?
No, hold on. Nice job, guys. Yes, sir.
Maddox, Houston. Come on now. Everybody in this room has a cell phone. I do have my advanced directive for trauma, for stroke, for heart, for airplane, for international, right here on my cell phone, as should all of us. And I look on other people's cell phone. I've not found anybody else. Join the 20th century. You know, I might be old. Never mind.
So what we'll do is we'll take your thumb while you're laying there, and we're going to get your phone to go.
He's got it on there. I will just say just one quick thing is that there are systems that allow for that. In fact, Oregon has a statewide registry of everybody's most pulsed, whatever they call it in Oregon. So technology can be used to our advantage. I couldn't agree with you more. Unfortunately, it's hard to get the public to buy
it. It would be a great thing if we knew where to look, right? I mean, we had a recent case where a guy came in with actually this injury and came in with a son with the advanced directive while we were getting neurosurgery lit up and doing all the things. And then the son came racing in and we had a great outcome, a family at bedside with, you know, no care. But we were like, wow, that was phenomenal. That's how it should go. But it was only because we knew, and it's such a rare occasion. We were excited about it because it's such a rare occasion that we had family that had access to the advanced directive. You know, I don't know who the national bully pulpit is to come up with one standard where it does exist on your phone and you would know to look and how to find it. It would be great.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Patty Byers from Miami. So I'd like to make a few comments based on what Dr. Hoyt was saying yesterday. And it has to do with resident engagement. It has to do with trust of the family, whether they're billionaires or whether they're undocumented aliens. And I think as critical care, like trauma people, our first trigger, as you have said, is to try to salvage the patient if you think they're salvageable. You know, obviously getting their history of their functionality before this is going to be easier with the billionaire than it is with the undocumented alien. But whatever the injury or pattern is, if it's salvageable, we need to push the envelope and try to save the patient. That being said, I think we have to be honest with the family. And I think that if you're going to have residents engaged, you have to turn them on to you being the leader of the ship of the care of this patient. So if you're going to go relying on palliative care to have these discussions for you, which often happens, and people sit back and let them have the conversation, it creates an entire bunch of confusion in what your motivation and goals are. So if you head the family, you can call palliative care in at some point when you decide you're going to back off. or when you feel it's not going to be good or whatever. But I think the conversation needs to be led by the surgical intensivist and demonstrate that you're taking the leadership on this and lead that discussion with the obvious reality that comes forward. And in that way, you get the best trust of the patient, and I think you're the best role model for the resident. And you can excite them, as you mentioned in your case, of the great reward you have of doing that and this having that outcome.
You hit the nail on the head. We're still driving the care of the patient with the help of others. I mean, I'm not brilliant at a lot of things, I promise you, and I need help. I need a lot of help, and I'm going to have those partners, whether it's palliative care or, a hepatologist, if there's some crazy thing going on that I need from them. But we have to model the behavior in the way that we want our residents to be in what we do every day. If we're disengaged, they're disengaged. It's no different than any other part of life, and I think that you've hit the nail on the head with that. Thank you.
Well, yes, please.
You have a minute for one more?
Sure, go ahead.
All right. I think the advanced directive thing is still an issue. I mean, one might have known if anybody had it on his cell phone, it would be Ken Maddox. And I think
that's... You have to cut his thumb off to get the phone to work.
But the fact is, cell phones usually don't come intact with trauma patients. If we're not awake, who's going to open up the cell phone? Yes. And the other thing is, advanced directives are important for two reasons. One is to have your caregivers give presumably what you thought out and you want them to do in the moment. I mean, I do have advanced directives, although not on the cell phone, but I would want to have mine also interpreted in the brains of my beloved, who are going to be the ones having the final word if I'm totally out of it. And the advanced directives are for them also, to make sure that they have a part in helping the injured person meet the fate that they really wanted to face. So I don't think just the black and white is going to solve the problem, no matter how we have it.
Yeah, I mean, one last comment. I don't think that anyone would say that any of these things are mutually exclusive, right? It's full court press for all of these things. We are going to do all of the medical and surgical stuff and light up the OR and get neurosurgery involved and intubate this patient and reverse his anticoagulation. At the same time, I also don't think it's okay to wait until day three. At the same time, we are going to invoke our discussions about advanced directives and goals of care in parallel while it's all happening. And yes, most of the time, he's going to get his cranny, he's going to get his anticoagulation reversed. But the fact that we've been having that conversation during those 24, 48, 72 hours while all that stuff's been happening in those first couple days, frankly, makes the conversation and the engagement with the family better because it started right off the bat.
So unfortunately, because we are basically out of time, I will just say what happened to this patient. So the family decided they did want everything done. You know, we got that he was fine before. He was just playing golf. He takes care of mom, my personal favorite. And unfortunately, he doesn't do well. He gets his trach, he gets his PEG, he gets transferred to a SNF, and subsequently gets transferred to a chronic care facility and never really rebounds and recovers. Unfortunately, we had three other cases that to highlight some of the other issues that our panelists were able to talk about, but in the interest of time, unfortunately, we did run out of it, so next year we'll have to plan for more. I want to thank you all, thank the panelists, thank you guys for your comments and for the engaging discussion. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.